My name is Walt Wongren. This is not really in the series of presentations that I planned on making this week. I think that it can fit, and I think that your intelligences can make what I'm about to present fit underneath the entire concept of love as the beautiful sacrifice. I gave six characteristics or six factors yesterday, which I will repeat yet again, but not tonight. What this is Christmas. And I happen to have with me, you people are so kind, you don't know how kind you are, because these are things I have not done before out loud. I'll just give you the basic stuff. I've been working on a manuscript for a book to be published by Harper & Row in the fall. It'll come out in the fall, and it'll be called The Manger is Empty. It's divided into three parts, and each has something to do with seasons, partly liturgical seasons. The first part is called the season, Christmas, the season in white. The second is called ordinary time, the season green. And the third is called the final advent, purple. So here I had this manuscript with a whole part one full of Christmas stuff, and I mentioned it. And what this comes out to be tonight is that I will do two things, and perhaps the only thing that relates them together is that they are about Christmas, which is today at Holden. I'm partly thinking of these people who are listening to the tape and scratching their heads right now and wondering, what in the devil is he trying to do? I'm going to read a story first. It's called A Quiet Chamber Kept for Thee, and it's a very easy, accessible story for approaching Christmas. I think what's going to happen here, there will be sacrifice in this story. I think what's going to happen is that I will kind of show you, this is your kindness to me, because you may not be interested in both sides of this. I'm going to show you the breadth that an author can work within, the genre that an author can go between. The first story is a sort of a remembrance of a Christmas past. It is a true experience as it occurred to me. It is a kind of a gift to those of you that are older than me, that are perhaps in the range of my parents, because it takes place, what is it? I was 10 years old then. I'm 45 now. It takes place 35 years ago. And it focuses somewhat on my father. And so I offer it as a gift to you. And it will not be difficult to listen to. It's an easy story, and it's benign. I like it. I like it very much. For theme, what it may be is that point where for a child, suddenly Christmas ceases to be form and childish. All the sweetness that the child trusts in and gets to be frightening. And then in the end, you will see what I mean by frightening, that Christmas or the forms of the church can be somewhat frightening. And then the child is able to perceive more deeply into some of the presence of love in these forms, maybe in a sacrificial way, as the child had not seen before. That will not be difficult. And it's not a terribly long story. I would have read it to you this afternoon, but we ran out of time. That's why it's here tonight. The second part is not quite as accessible, and it's going to ask you to work a little bit with me. It is a poem. It's not the one I read at supper tonight. It's one that I worked on very hard. And it approaches the event of Christmas, the ceremony of Christmas, and the theology of Christmas. In poetry, that's very compact language. An awful lot happens in a short space of time. I will read you the story and see if perhaps you have any comments or questions, and then I'll watch my time and begin on the poem, which is called The Christ Mass. All kinds of things are meant by that. And perhaps you'll have a chance to respond. The story is called A Quiet Chamber Kept for Thee. Relax. It's easy. Nostalgia. Perhaps there's some nostalgia for you. That will be good. And this is the story. You know I like those little noises, those comfortable little noise, people getting comfortable. I really like that. I used to tell stories to my children when they were little. I used to tell stories to my brothers and sisters. And always when I started to tell a story, their bodies said, I'm ready. I'm receptive. And it was that nestling down. It was that getting ready to be comfortable. It's the best way to learn, in a posture of comfort. Story. This is the way it was in the old days. The milkman still delivered milk to our back door summer and winter, and the milk came in bottles, and the bottles were shaped with a bulge at the top for the cream, you see, which separated from the milk after the milk had been bottled. Cream was common in those days, so was butter, Margarine was less appealing because according to Canadian law, it had to be sold in its original color, which was white like lard, and could be colored only by the customer after it had been bought, or so my mother told me. She mixed an orange powder into the margarine to make it yellow. I helped. But this is the way it was in the old days. The milkman still brought the milk in a horse-drawn wagon to our house in the middle of the morning. And especially in the winter, we would, as my mother said, tune our ears to hear his coming. That is, we listened for the kindly congregational clinking of the glass in his wagon as he toiled down the street in our direction. Then we rushed to an upstairs window and watched. You could, in the cold Canadian air, hear his coming from far away. We were at the window long before the milkman was bustling up our walk with the bottles in a wire basket. And that, of course, was the point. My mother wanted us to bring the milk in right away, or else it would freeze, and the cream would lift its hat on an ice cream column. How do you do? Fine, thank you, cream, and how are you? But this is the way it was, particularly on Christmas Eve day. We spent the major portion of the morning at the upstairs window, giggling, whispering, and waiting for the milkman to come. Tradition. My mother was glad to be shed of us on the day that ran her crazy with preparations. I think we knew that then. But for our own part, we did truly want to see the evidence of how cold it was outside. It was important that Christmas Eve be cold. And it was the milkman's mare, you see, who presented us with the evidence. So here came the mare, in a slow walk, nodding, drawing the wagon behind her, even when her master was rushing up the sidewalks making deliveries. She never stopped. The mare was blowing plumes of steam from her nostrils. Her chin had grown a beard of hoarfrost. Her back was blanketed. The blanket smoked. The air was cold. The air was very cold. And our stomachs contracted with joy within us, and some of us laughed at the rightness of the weather. So here came the mare, treading a hardened snow. The snow banked 6 feet high on either side of the street, except at sidewalks and driveways. The snow was castles we would be kings of tomorrow. The snow collected on the mare, whose forelock and eyelashes were white. She shivered the flesh on her flanks, sending off small showers of snow, and so did we shiver. Oh, cold. The air was a crystal bowl of cold. The day was perfectly right, and we could scarcely stand the excitement. Downstairs in our house, directly below us, was a room which had been locked 2 days ago against our entering in. This was my father's tradition, the which he never varied year to year. Always he locked the door by removing its knob, transfiguring thereby the very spirit of the room, and all we could do was spy at the knob hole and wonder at the mysteries concealed inside. My brothers and sisters pestered that hole continually, chirping among themselves like snowbirds on a holly tree, puffing their imaginations like feathers all around them. Tonight, on Christmas Eve itself, we would all line up, and my father would unlock the door, and one by one we would enter the wondrous room. This much we knew. The Christmas tree was in there. Therefore, even in the morning at the upstairs window, we could scarcely stand the excitement. Tonight, and lo, it was very, very cold. Let me be a little more precise. We were living in Edmonton, Alberta. The year was 1954. My Lord, am I that old? And I was 10, the oldest of the 7 children of my parents. I've implied that we were all excited on that particular Christmas Eve morning, and so we were. But though my brothers and sisters could manifest their excitement with unbridled delight, I could not mine. I absolutely refused to acknowledge or signal excitement. They loved the sweet contraction in their stomachs. I was afraid of them, for I had that very year become an adult, silent, solemn, watchful, and infinitely cautious. So my brothers and sisters laughed and clapped the day away. They spilled colored sugar on cookie dough and covered the kitchen with a sweet mess, all unworried, unafraid. They claimed by faster stabs of the finger their individual treasures from the Sears catalogs. And so they allowed their dreams to soar, and so the day passed away. I didn't blame them. They were innocent. They could dare the dangers they didn't see. These children could rush headlong toward the evening recklessly, but I could not. I held myself in a severe restraint. Because what if you hope and it doesn't happen? It's treacherous to hope. The harder you hope, the more vulnerable you are. And if you believe a thing, but it's not true, what then? Well, the instant you see the deception, you die a little. And it hurts exactly in your soul where once you had believed. I knew all this. I had learned that excitement is composed of hope and faith together, but of faith and hope in promises yet unkept. And I was not about to let excitement run away with me, or I would certainly crash as I had crashed the year before. Last Christmas Eve, in the midst of opening his presents, my brother Paul had burst into tears. I don't know why. I didn't know why. But I was shocked to discover that the Christmas time was not inviolate. I was horrified that pain could invade the holy ceremony, and I was angry at my father that he could not protect my brother from tears. There was a fraud here. The traditions were as thin as a crystal globe and empty. I could do nothing about that when I was 9 years old, nothing but in sympathy with my brother's sob, nothing but grieve to the same degree that I had believed. But by 10, I was an adult. And if Christmas gave me nothing really, and if the traditions could not protect me from assault, then I would protect myself. No. The more excited I was, the more I was determined not to be. And the more I cast my face into a frown. I'm speaking with precision now. None of us could stand the season's excitement, but I was frightened by mine and chose to acknowledge it to no one, not to my father, not to my mother, not to myself. Adult. By supper, the world was black outside, so the noise inside seemed louder than it had been, and we the closer together. In bathrobes, we ate soup. We had bathed, bright faces, soft faces, dashing eyes, and faces glowing with their goodness. Children smile with a self-conscious piety on Christmas Eve, nearly drowning in convictions of their goodness. My brothers and sisters ran to their bedrooms bubbling and began to dress themselves. I stood before the bathroom mirror and combed my hair with water, unsmiling. Always, we went to church on Christmas Eve to participate in the children's service. Nothing happened at home till after that. This was the tradition, and tradition itself began when we would venture into the cold, cold night, and next perform the parts we had been practicing for endless Saturdays. And if we were nervous about the lines we had to say, well, that only intensified our excitement for the time thereafter, the room, you know, the mystery, and the tree. My hair froze as soon as I walked outside. Crackled when I touched it, it felt like a cap, cold. My face tightened in the night wind, and I blew ghosts of steam which the wind took up from my lips. They were leaving me, and I couldn't and wouldn't come back again. The family sat three, three, and three in the three seats of a VW van. I, in the farthest corner of the back, slouched, my hands stuffed in my pockets. I forced myself to repeat my lines for the pageant. I was to be Isaiah. So then it was a blazing church we crowded into, a small church filled with yellow light and excitement. People were laughing simply at the sight of each other, as though familiar faces were a fine hilarity. You, Harold! Ha ha ha! You! Well, Merry Christmas to you! In the narthex, the press of people was close because we wore thick coats, and the children were shooed downstairs to giddy into costumes, and the adults clumped upstairs to wait in pews, and holly greens were knocked from the windowsills, and the windows were black with night. Who is so foolish as to laugh in such an atmosphere and not to fear that he's losing control? Not me. Not me. Class by class, the children trooped into the chancel and sang with wide-open mouths, all full of faith. Eyes unafraid. Little ones waved to their parents by the crooking of four fingers, like scratching air. They positively shined with happiness. Nobody thought to be fearful. I, in my turn, stared solemnly at the massed congregation and intoned, For unto us a child is born, unto us a son. I saw the adults all shoulder to shoulder in ranks before me, nodding, craning, encouraging me by grins, not a whit afraid. Wonderful counselor. No one was ready to cry in the midst of so much cheer and danger. Naive people, or else they were cunning. Well, neither would I. Mighty God, I roared. I would not cry. Neither would I succumb to the grins of these parents, no. Everlasting Father! Oh, no, I would not risk disappointment again this year. The Prince of Peace! I thundered, and I quit. No emotion whatsoever. I did not laugh. I did not smile. Both of these are treacherous. I made a glowering prophet altogether. My mother and father sat nearly hidden 10 rows back. I noticed them just before descending from the chancel. Walnuts, tangerines, a curled rock candy all in a small brown bag, and every kid got a bag at the end of the service. A bag was thrust toward me, and I took it, but I didn't giggle, and I didn't open it. No, sir, you won't entice me to gladness or gratitude. And the people, humping into their coats again, called, "Merry Christmas! Merry Christmas!" The pleasant tumult of departure. They were flowing outward into the black night, tossing goodwill over their shoulders. Merry Christmas! No, ma'am, you won't disarm me this year. Even now, my father delayed our going home. Tradition. As long as I can remember, my father found ways to while the time, increasing excitement, until his children fairly panted piety and almost swooned in their protracted goodness. You can't be good too long. Don't breathe through your noses, my father sang out, hunched at the wheel of the van. Traditional joke. You'll steam the windows. Breathe through your ears, he called. Every year, the same joke. It was silliness. We breathe through our noses anyway. Frosting the windows a quarter inch thick, enclosing our family in a little space in the night. With mittened hands and elbows, we rubbed peepholes through the muzzy ice. We were driving through the city to view its Christmas decorations. Lights and trees and stables and beasts and effigies of the Holy Family. I looked out my little hole and regarded the scenes with melancholy. There was a tremendous tableau of Dickensian carolers in someone's yard, some dozen people in tall hats and scarves and muffs, their mouths wide open, their eyes screwed up to heaven in a transport of song, their bodies a wooden fiction. They didn't move. They didn't produce a note of music. So nobody heard them. But nobody minded, because nobody was singing, and no living body was anywhere near to hear them anyway. This was worse than silliness. This was dangerous. I found myself suddenly suffering for the wooden figures, as though they could be lonely in the deserted snow. Any feeling at all made me vulnerable. I stopped looking. My boots crunched snow when we walked to the door of our house. A wind with crystals caused my eyes to tear, but resolutely, I was not crying. And still my father delayed our going into the room. Oh, who could control the spasms of excitement? Oh, Dad, let's do it and be done with it. But it was tradition upon our returning home to change our church clothes into pajamas and to gather in the kitchen. Across the hall, the door was still closed, but its knob had been replaced. I saw that knob and my heart kicked inside of me, so I chewed my bottom lip and I frowned like thunder. No. It won't be what it ought to be. It never is. Adult. And always, always the rungs of my father's tradition. We lined up in the kitchen from the youngest to the oldest. I stood last in the line of seven. My littlest sister was clasping her hands and raising her shining votive face to my father, who stood before her facing us. Her hair hung down her back to her waist. Blithe child. Her blue eyes burst with trust. I pitied her. My father prayed a prayer, tormenting us. For the prayer evoked the very images I was refusing. Infant Jesus, gift of God, love come down from heaven, all of the things that conspired to make me glad at Christmas. My poor heart bucked and argued with that prayer. No, I would not hope. No, I would not permit excitement. No, no, I would not be set up for a second disappointment. We were a single minute from entering the room. And I might have succeeded at severity, except that then we sang a song. The same song we had always sung, and the singing undid me altogether. Music destroys me. A hymn will reduce me to infancy. 9 bare voices, unaccompanied in the kitchen, we sang, Ah, dearest Jesus, holy child. And I began to tremble. Make thee a bed soft, undefiled. The very sweetness of the melody caused my defenses to fall. I began to hope and I began to fear, both at once. I began to wish, and wishing made me terrified. I began all over again to believe, but I had never ceased my unbelief. I began to panic. Within my heart that it may be. Dreadfully now, I yearned for some good thing to be found in that room, but dreadfully, I say, because I was an adult. I'd put away childish things. I'd been disillusioned and knew no good thing to be in there. This was a pitiless sham. A quiet chamber kept for thee. And my father whispered, He turned to the door. Little squeals escaped my sister. He grasped the knob and opened the door upon a soft light, and his children, one by one, crept through the door and into that room. All of his children, save one. I lingered in the doorway, looking, not breathing. There, scattering a dim and varied light, was the Christmas tree my father had decorated alone. Every single strand of tinsel hanging straight down of its own slim weight, since he hung them individually, patiently, one by one, and would not hasten the duty by tossing them in fistfuls. Tradition. The tree he had hidden 3 days ago behind a knobless door. There, in various places about the room, were 7 piles of gift, a pile for each of us. There, in the midst of them, my mother sat smiling on the floor, her skirts encircling her, her own radiance smiting my eyes, for she verged on laughter. My mother always laughed when she gave presents, however long the day had been, however crazy she had almost gone. I began to blink rapidly. But there, unaccountably, was my father, standing center in the room and gazing directly at me. And this is the wonder fixed in my memory, that the man himself was filled with a yearning, painful expectation, but that he, like me, was withholding still his own excitement on account of me. Everything else in this room was just as it had been the year before and the year before that, but this was new. This thing I had never seen before, that my father too had passed his day in the hope that risks a violent hurt. My father too had had to trust the promises against their disappointments. So said his steady eyes on me. But among the promises to which my father was willing to commit his soul, his hope and his faith, the chiefest was this, that his eldest son should soften and be glad. If I had grown adult in the year 1954, then lo, how like a child my father had become. The colored lights brushed the side of his face. He gazed at me, waiting for me, waiting for his Christmas to be received by his son and returned to him again. And I began to cry. Oh, my father. Silently, merely spilling the tears and staring straight back at my father, defenseless because there was no need for defenses, I cried, glad and unashamed. Because what was this room for so long locked, which I was entering? Why, it was my own heart. And why had I been afraid? Because I thought I'd find it empty, a hard, unfeeling thing. But there in the room was my Father. And there in my Father was the love that had furnished this room, preparing it for us no differently than He had last year prepared it, yet trusting and yearning, desiring our joy. And what else could such a love be but my Jesus drawing near? Look, then, what I have found in my Father's room, in my heart, after all, the dearest Lord Jesus, Holy Child, the Nativity of our Lord. I leaned my cheek against the door jamb and grinned as a grown-up as 10 years old and sobbed as though I were 2. And my Father moved from the middle of the room and walked toward me empty-handed, but He spread His hands to gather me to Himself, and I put my arms around His harder body, and so we, the both of us, were full. That's the story. Now, I don't know if you have any comments or if I should go, or questions immediately to the poem.
When your Father is the minister of the church, they can draw that thing out until the last.
Isn't that something?
The worst thing they could ever do.
They'll kill you. Oh, they'll kill you with tradition. Well, Dad was pastor. That's right. All these traditions. I don't even remember. I don't even remember what I got, to be perfectly honest with you. I remember that my mother mostly gave us shirts that smelled really good. The four boys were the oldest, then came a girl, then came a boy, then came a girl. My mother had this thing about dressing all four of us in the same clothes. And we got the same clothes at Christmas time, and you put on the flannel shirts and you smell Sears or Pennies or something like that, and I liked the smell. But I don't remember what I got. Don.
What's that story for you? What does that do for you?
The story?
Yeah.
Oh, it does a number of things. The nice thing about a story like that for the author is that it becomes a kind of an external cup, a vase, or a container of a memory. My dad obviously has read that as well, and so has my mother. And for us, it becomes reparation. It becomes recognition. My parents can see that I wasn't a fool, after all, when I was little. Well, you know, silence is very difficult for parents to take. And I was a hard child because I was very, very silent. And on the other hand, it becomes for me a container of the memory. I read that and I re-experience all that time. What I like about it, I should tell you, and that's why you were kind to listen, I like to go back to Canada. I love the winters in Canada. I love the cold. And so when you write that, you know, I'm writing this in Evansville, Indiana, which is 90 degrees But there's a wonder of leaving and entering into the fiction that you're writing, the story that you're writing, and then all the details you gather, both for the reader, but also for yourself, so that there can be that re-experience of the joy of the cold again. Things like that. Yes, Julia. I think about 3 years, and then revised it several times. It did appear in the Lutheran Standard. No, I don't know what it appeared in. It appeared in something. They asked, this is a nice thing. They had asked for a Christmas piece, and this had been on my mind for a little while, particularly the irony of the locked door. And so with that as an impetus, I wrote it, and I think it was about 3 years ago. Matter of fact, I think I remember writing that. I remember a lot of the stuff that I wrote and what I do. What I find that I do, it's something that John Gardner has written about, an author, and I recommend the books to you that he writes. What some of the titles are
on
being a novelist? Not on excellence. Anyway, he talks about being a novelist, something like that. Novelist is it, and he says, Gardner says that as he writes, it's almost as though he's watching a movie. And as he watches the movie, he has to be careful to get the right details down. Now that's a very simple way of saying a very complicated thing, but as I tell a story, as I tell it on the page. I need to be visual. I need to see, and then I need to use all my senses to smell, taste, feel, hear. And as I see these things happen, mostly what I know is happening is I'm remembering how I've seen children do that, but it appears right here. And then the image comes with it. The image comes as a gift, almost, at that point. Do you all hear what she's saying? She talked about the treasure of traditions. And that in some circumstances you don't have that opportunity to repeat the traditions that you had when you were a child. But it becomes necessary then to establish new ones. I absolutely agree. If I had an image in there that stuck in my mind, it was the room. The room which has a very severe shape, contains things. And the room was, in my mind, tradition. And as much as we kick against it and buck against it when we're children, when we're older, that room remains still containing what I discovered at that age, which was the love of my parents, the love of ancestors, the love of Jesus, that found its shape and its form in these repeated activities that were done again and again. I visit the elderly. I mentioned this last week, but I visit the elderly when they're very old and hardly able to move anything. They're in nursing homes or whatever. And you sing, Müde bin ich, das Ruh. Or you sing German, or you speak to the 23rd Psalm. And they're back to being children again, which doesn't give up anything of all the age that they lived. It doesn't give up anything of all the wisdom that they gathered. But it binds it together with that sweet peace that a child had at that point, and that's tradition. That's tradition because they sang those songs when they were little, and those songs carried, they didn't know it at the time. We don't know at the time, but carried such a profound treasure, as you say, such a weight of meaning. And I mean meaning. It's not a pointless life when you are moved by a song like that. Praising liturgy that we go back to. As a poet, I see no difference, and I would suggest the same for artists in general. I see no difference between the forms of liturgy, which remain as forms. That doesn't mean the exact words. No. I mean the forms of liturgy, which sometimes you clean out and renew with new words, new activity, new hymns, but you obey those forms. Yeah. Songs the same. That you're always buying into the long history of the people that was preserved in songs, but you renew them. Yes. Here.
With all the
Go ahead, yes. I'll answer you double. That's a good question. Or did it come later? Both. And I mean it. And I don't mean to be silly. Both. It is curious how wise children are, generally. And I really believe that most children, although they don't know it, maybe some more than others, walk around with a third eye. You know how you buy these hats with these big eyes that are going like this on it? Well, we children, but we forget this when we're adults, and it's the artist's point to remember this. We children often walk around with this third eye behind us, watch the people. And we watch and we laugh, and there's something in our mind that clicks and says, oh, isn't that wonderful? I'm laughing now. And then of course, if that's real, insistent eye, you stop really laughing and you start faking laughing because you're aware that you're laughing. Some children are so God-blessed that they don't have that eye at all. They just live their lives. But I had that eye, and I constantly watched how I did things. And so there was something in me aware of this separation. Obviously, not with the sophistication that the story has it. But there was something. So then you watch children when you get older, and you keep saying, I remember. Your heart pities that little child, even though the child may not be fully aware of what she or he is going through. But then, and so then you begin to remember. And then the beauty of writing is that it not only resurrects those things that you knew back then, that you're fighting the danger and all that sort of stuff, but it understands it, and it can give it form. Sometimes the writing itself is a sort of setting free. It's a being set free from the thing that had unconsciously been a cloying thing on you. Does that make sense? Yeah. So something in me understood it, only in those days, I'm not kidding, I just thought, Wally's weird. But I now find that probably most kids are privately thinking, I'm weird, because I feel different at times from other people and I watch. Isn't that too bad that we do it in cycles? Of course I did. Of course I returned to my nature. I would like to say, that here then from that point on, no, I was the oldest. I was so moral it irritated my parents. I used to whistle when they do bad things. It was terrible. I would be so upset when my parents did certain things that I knew were bad, and so I'd go into my room and whistle loud so I wouldn't have to hear it. But I was a solemn child. I was a most uncheerful child. And yet that isn't to say that these moments didn't occur. And that in those moments, my mother, this I wrote into the book The Orphean Passages. One of the most beautiful memories that I have is Easter Sunday morning. That was my mother. You know, my father handled Christmas, my mother handled Easter, sort of. Although my mother handled my mother kind of handled the presents at Christmas much more than my father did. My father did the tree. My mother handled Easter and hiding of the eggs. And for me, there was one beautiful moment all 1,000 Easters that I ever experienced, same moment. She would hide the eggs in a lot of places that were open, where it was not difficult for us to find them. And we'd rush. It was always after Sunday, you know. It was after you'd been to church and all that kind of stuff. We always worship first, you know. First God, then fun. Always. And then we'd be home, and I remember we rushed around for the eggs, and there was always one I couldn't find. What she would often do is put our initials on the eggs so that we could make our names. Isn't that neat? We'd find our names. We'd be finding ourselves. It's sort of a self-naming. Remember that. That's a good thought. There was always one I couldn't find. And this is how this may have only happened once in my memory, but tradition does this too. It reduplicates the one beautiful moment, so it seems to have happened often. That I was in the living room frustrated that I couldn't find the W or the L in my name. And I began to hear this laughter tinkling through the house. My mother could laugh so beautifully. It was like music. She laughed soprano. And I would hear this laughter, and I didn't know where she was in the house. It would be like upstairs, downstairs, and I'd follow the laughter. And it seemed that always she was sitting on the attic steps, which goes up to where our bedroom was, and would just be laughing because there was the egg right there in the corner. And her laughter drew me, and then I saw the egg, and she was laughing at my silliness and at the fact that she had done it again. She had tricked me, and I would laugh, and we would laugh helplessly. So that those moments would arise again and again and again. Let me tell you a story. I don't know if I ever told. I might even have told this here. There are several spinning in my head here. If you guys want to talk about poetry, we could still do that later. But I think we have a mood here that doesn't quite go into some of the difficulties of this poem. I'm between two stories right now. This is very uncomfortable. I don't know. I want to tell one about my mother, and I want to tell one about Christmas. I don't have time. I know I told part of the Christmas one the last time I was here 3 years ago, and so you may have heard it. Oh, this is really halting between two gods. I'll tell my mother. When I lived in that attic in Chicago, that's Chicago now, Paul and I slept in the same bed. It was an attic. That's what you got to know from the very beginning of this. That's where the egg was. That's what made me think of it. It'll show you something of the boldness of my mother. Frightening boldness. Dad had changed an attic into a bedroom. And then he said unto us, "This is a bedroom." But he was wrong. It was an attic. And there was no way to disguise the fact that it smelled like an attic. It looked like an attic. It was a long room. You know how the ceiling comes down, all the way down like that? And we had one little naked bulb hanging in the middle. The one that flies aimed at all the time. And we had one window at the far end, and let's put it this way. One window at that end and long wall, and our bed came out right in the middle, and it was an attic. And the stairs came right up, and there was a sort of a railing along the stairs like that so we wouldn't fall. And it smelled like an attic. Now, the problem with it being an attic, this is the year I was, this is in Orphean passages, the year I was in first grade. The problem with it being an attic is what lives in the attic besides you. Other things do. This is true. And I began to recognize it was in the fall of the year after I walked to school. I walked to school a mile. I began to realize that every night when Paul and I went to bed together underneath the bed in this attic room, there was a robber. I was absolutely convinced that there was a robber. Remember it, Lynn? You nod? Yeah. Well, this has something to do with this whole business of 10 years old, although at the time I was 6 years old, because Paul did not know there was a robber, and I knew it, and I didn't tell Paul. Because I was the oldest, and I was protecting not only Paul, but the whole family from the robber. There really was a robber under there. Now, I don't know whether I smelled the robber or whether I could feel the kind of the motion. Well, you know that when you're in bed and your back and your butt is lying on a mattress, these are very sensitive anatomy parts. And your butt can, they can feel things going on underneath there like that. There's a communication, and it was a robber. Had no idea what the robber looked like because I never looked. I wouldn't look. This was part of my power, that the robber did not know that I knew that the robber was in the house. See, that was my advantage. I knew that the robber was there. The robber didn't know that I knew that I was. So this is what would happen. Paul and I would go to bed always at 8 o'clock. My mother sent us to bed at 7, 7:30, 8, depending on the time of year. We always went to bed when the kids were still outside singing and the light was up and all that sort of. We had to lie in bed like that. And I honestly, this is true, told my brother stories to while the time away so that he would not attend to what was under our bed, so that he would fall asleep. And then I was left awake long hours trying to decide what I should do. I felt that as soon as I fell asleep, the robber would creep out. And so I was in effect being the guard of the house by lying there awake, singing, making noises, creaking the bed springs, anything to let the robber know that I was awake, the robber couldn't come out. What I fell into doing was to waiting until I heard my parents go to bed. Then I let the robber out. And I did that by falling asleep. Then I could fall asleep because I felt that the robber had to do everything in secret. Do you understand this? All these rules. Oh, and night after night after night, I was getting so exhausted. Because my parents went to bed late. My dad would go to bed early. My mother went to bed later. She always read so forth downstairs. And I had to wait till I heard the door close, and then I could in relief fall asleep. So there came a day when my mother said about 7:30, time to go to bed. And I said, no. And my brother started toddling right for the stairs, fool. That fool was always obedient. I said, Paul, don't. I said, we can't go to bed. And my mother looked at me and said, Wally, you go to bed. I said, I can't. I cannot go to bed. It's like last straw. It's like I cannot do this one more thing. I said, Ma, crying, Mother, I can't go to bed. Let's talk. Can we talk? So Paul stayed down, and Mom and I went into the one room in the house where we could talk, which is the bathroom. Mom sat on the side of the tub, and I sat on the toilet, and she said, okay, Wally, now what is this? Why can't you go to bed? Assuming all kinds of reasons, you know, that I would have in my mind. I suppose assuming that I was about to make up some wonderful story. And I remember that I sat on that throne and said with as much sincerity, I was learning in those days how you talk to parents when you really mean it. You use the word honestly before you wear it out. Honestly, Mom, honestly. You know, and then pretty soon you're saying it for when you're really lying, and then you got to think up another. Honestly, Mom, I said, I can't go to bed. I said, there's a robber under my bed. She said, oh, Wally. No, there isn't. And instantly I knew that I had made an error. I said, yes, Mom, yes, there's a robber. Every night, ever since I've gone to school, there's been a robber under the bed. I've been keeping it under the bed. And the whole time, her face was unmoved, hard as stone. She'd found out what my thing was. She said, no, there isn't. But she began to realize that I believed it. She said, come, I'll show you. And I began to panic. My heart, nothing scares my mother. Scares. She's still living. 71 years old. She lives in the mountains of Colorado. And you know how the rangers will say, if you meet a bear, go the other way, don't fool with a bear. When my mother meets a bear, the bear goes the other way. This has always been the case. She saved us from bears. When we used to camp in Jasper, my mother, when she would see a bear, all the campers would duck, hide, scatter. I mean, the wise ones, the obedient ones, my brother, scattering. But my mother would take a pan and a spoon. Bam, 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 whoop, went the bear. What was this? And my mother rose, big as Vesuvius. You know, she was bigger than any other bear like that. Bears ran. I was terrified because my mother marched out of the bathroom, marched to the steps, and began to walk up those steps. I was terrified because I knew that nothing scares my mother but robbers kill. And I was afraid of what that robber would do to my mother. A robber is not a bear. My mother did not know that. A robber is vile and ugly and hateful. It can do things without remorse whatsoever. And I was scared for my mother. I followed her. I crept up the stairs behind her. She goes, boom, boom. You can always hear my mother walk through the house. Always. She used to put a bell downstairs so she didn't have to come upstairs. If we were making noise too long upstairs, it was a ship's bell. It was a captain's bell. Bam, 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 bam. She'd ring that bell so we'd have to go quiet. walk up the stairs. That's the worst sound of all, you know, after the bell. If anything would strike terror in a robber's heart, it would be mother's feet on the stairs. But not this robber. And I remember that I followed her creeping, almost as though I were that little deer. And she walked right across the room. Wherever, from the stairs she came to the bed, and I leaned back against the railing of the steps like this, just horrified what she was going to do. I knew what she was going to do. I knew my mother. She leaned down like this. She took a hold of the coverlet, and she whipped it back, and she said, "See?" And I crept down from where I was, and I sighted along the floor. She said, "No robber." And I looked, and I saw dust bunnies, I saw mess, and I saw no robber. No robber. That night. Now, I honestly did not blame my mother, but she had messed up. She had messed up horribly. Because what she had proven to Paul and me is that the robber was still outside the window. And that once we were in bed, now we had to watch not just underneath the bed, we had to watch the window too. No, let me make that deeper. What my mother had done was to remove herself as an ally in this war against robbers. That's what she had done. Because there was a robber. I mean, my mother was just wrong about the timing. She was not wrong about the robber. And now Paul knew too. And so Paul and I had to work this thing out together. Alone, without my mom. That's the problem. I would like to have had my mom as a support. But I lost her at that point. This is what Paul and I did. We talked it through. We figured it out. From that day on, when we mounted the steps to go to bed, my brother and I, me first, Paul second, sang hymns. At the top of our lungs, we shouted hymns as we came up the room. "Rock of Ages, cleft for me," we shouted it. All up and down Overhill Street, the people said, "Mrs. Wongren's children got religion." "Let me hide." The reason that we did that was that we decided that our music could convert the robber to Christianity before we got there. And a Christian robber wouldn't kill us. It worked. Let me tell you two things. My mother was right, obviously, but my mother was wrong. My mother was right. There was no physical robber underneath the bed. My mother was wrong. And I think this is going to fit one of the questions when we talk about what is art and what is remembering of the stories and how much does a child really recognize. Children meet problems with their imaginations. And instead of figuring things out in intellectual ways, in geometric ways, I don't know what the language is for this, in rational ways, they figure things out in imaginary ways. There was a robber in my life. I promise you there was. Only I will give it its true name now as an adult. It was evil. I was beginning to know in the first grade that the world is not kind, that the world is dangerous and it will hurt you, it will kill you. And in my mind, it had all been bound up in this issue. That it was a robber. And I needed somehow or other this amorphous, horrible thing. When I walked to school, Max Gledek always greeted me with a punch in my stomach. Toom! And he knocked the wind out of me. It was always, I mean, he was a nice guy, and he didn't know he did this. He was very strong. And he would always leave me gasping for air. Max Gledek was a piece of that robber. My son, I will close with this last part. I think perhaps what I told you about the robber is all of your experience, or many of your experiences as you deal with these issues. My son Matthew had the same experience. And Fan, my wife, knew what to do. For Matthew, though, it wasn't a robber. When he was a child, he used to have grasshoppers that lived in his pillow. When he went to sleep, his pillow formed a great big chasmic hole, an abyss. And he always thought, as he was sleeping, that he was hanging over a hole, and at the bottom of the hole were these enormous grasshoppers that chewed like this, sideways, with wings that would rattle and make terrible noises. And he knew that they were waiting at the bottom of the hole for the little boy to fall down, and they would eat him up. Matthew, you've seen him around here. now he's basketball and he's going to college. But in those days, he was short and he was fast as a bullet. He would shoot out of his bedroom when he had those thoughts, and he'd shoot down the hall and he'd boom, hit the bed between Than and me, no matter what we were doing. Eyes wide open. Little fro on his head, poo, straight and stiff lying in the bed between us like that. We'd say grasshoppers. He'd say grasshoppers. Oh, he was terrified. All the evil in the world is in his pillow. That's a horrible thing. It comes very near a child. I didn't help the kid at all because I believed him. No, what I mean is I used to dream. As soon as he started doing that, my love for that child would make me dream a dream. And Matthew and I would be walking along a green field in my dream. I'd be holding his hand, and it was a deep blue sky and a deep green field. And these are supposed to be comfortable colors, but in my dream, they were always too strong and dangerous. And as we walked, Matthew, with all of his excitement, the son always had excitement, would you know how you can turn your hand in a silly putty and slip out? He'd slip out of my hand like that, and I'd cry after him in the dream, and I'd say, Matthew, watch out, watch out. And he'd run ahead of me, so happy, so innocent in my dream, and then he'd disappear. And I knew what had happened. He'd fallen down that hole. And in my dream, I would run up to the hole and I'd see him falling. By the way, those of you who heard Elizabeth and the Water Troll, this is where this comes from. I'd see him falling, and in my dream, I'd have two choices. One is to run back and get help, and the other would be to jump in and be with my son. And in my dream, I somehow always did both. I would be running back and falling with my son at exactly the same time. This is called empathy. This is called sympathy. But it does no good to Matthew. I mean, I can't jump up from my bed and run to his little bunk bed and lie next to him and say, yeah, Matthew, it's right. But one night when the child bulleted himself into our bed, Than took him by hand after he had calmed down and went back to his room and had him lie on his bed and sat next to him and asked him to tell her all over again about grasshoppers, and he did. And she said, that pillow? And he said, yes. And she said, but do you know that grasshoppers are finicky? She said, do you know that grasshoppers live only in certain pillows? Now, I don't remember whether that pillow was a feather pillow or one of these plastic cushion type pillows, but Than took that pillow with Matthew into the kitchen and stuffed it in a garbage can, got him a different kind of pillow, brought it back and said, grasshoppers don't live in this pillow. And they didn't. Isn't she wise? She really is, because what she did then was to companion Matthew according to his own terms and not to say that the child was struggling with a fiction. It wasn't a fiction. It was very real, but translated into imagination. So she dealt with it on an imaginary level. I don't know why I told you that, except that it was a nice story. I think it's warm, and I thank you for your attention.